It is Locked On NBA. I'm David Locke. I am the radio voice of the Utah Jazz. We just got beat by the Houston Rockets. Sean Kelly is the great radio voice of the New Orleans Pelicans. They just got beat by the Warriors. And we have the most anticipated conference final we've had in years. So who better than the two guys that are sitting home with nothing to do because of how great the Rockets and the Warriors are. We'll talk some general playoffs and then we'll preview the Rockets and the Warriors upcoming on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Joined by Sean Kelly, radio voice of the New Orleans Pelicans. I figured the two of us now have off time for the first time in a while. Sean works harder than I do. He does all sorts of Saint stuff also. But might as well get the two guys who are dispatched by the two best teams in the Western Conference that are playing the most anticipated conference final we've probably had since the old Celtics 76ers days of Julius and Larry. I'm not sure. What's your thought, Sean? Do you think we've had a series as anticipated on the conference final level as this one?
Wow, I'd have to think back. Maybe one of the Spurs matchups, but nothing that's garnered the, I guess, season-long anticipation like this one has. And I would say that while I think a lot of us thought that it would end up being these two teams, with the way that the West played out this year, it certainly didn't look like any kind of a certainty and just until the last 48 to 72 hours. It was just kind of a long and winding road.
Yeah, and then I think when it really got right down to it, they both showed that they're totally dominant. You know, game three against the Rockets against us and game four for you, were those the Rockets and Warriors saying, hey, wait a sec, let's make sure none of you get any ideas here.
Yeah, isn't it crazy? I mean, Golden State, I think, had 58 wins in the regular season, and they said it was a down year. That seems silly to me. They were as dominant as we expected them to be, but I thought that the overall quality of the West may have taken some of the shine off of how good those two teams played throughout. They didn't get lost in the shuffle. They were just joined by many other great stories along the way.
Here, we'll just be total Western Conference bias, since there's no such thing as a West Coast bias compared to an East Coast bias. Pelicans beat the Cavaliers, Celtics, Sixers, and Raptors in a playoff series. Do they get all four of them in your mind?
Well, they would be competitive in all four. They might win three of the four. I just think that what Cleveland did, you know, really focusing in on LeBron James, the performance that he had was, I wouldn't say unbeatable, but certainly formidable in a lot of ways. And what he did all by himself, playing all 82 games and starring here in the postseason is remarkable. You know, a lot of folks will want to punch a hole in LeBron James's legacy by saying that he never played in the Western Conference. I think there's some validity to that, but at the end of the day, you still have to get the job done, and nobody else is going to let you just have it. And so, therefore, I think that probably the Pelicans would find themselves in the same position in the East, maybe one step further. And the same might be said for the Utah Jazz as well.
It's an interesting discussion. I mean, I think, and frankly, Boston just, every time we count them out, they're just as strong as they were before. So either Brad Stevens or Al Horford, which are seem to be the two things that are constant, deserve much more credit than I gave them with that question. I think they're getting the credit, so I don't want to say more credit than they're getting. But they deserve more credit than I gave them with that question.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, not only do they have a lot of good complementary pieces, the story of Jason Tatum, I think, is remarkable in that, number one, we found ourselves in a fantastic rookie class, and Tatum got better as he went and did not necessarily hit a rookie wall. And the moment wasn't too big for him. I thought that he was as much of a story for them as anything else. And maybe one more thing.
Yeah.
Brad Stevens ought to be the coach of the year.
Yeah, that guy, I think, well, he, Casey, I think Quinn Snyder's going to win it because I think the Western Conference votes are going to go to Quinn and the Eastern Conference are going to get split between Brad Stevens and Dwayne Casey. But I think Brad
Stevens. Brad
Stevens.
I could make an argument for all three.
Right. And I think coaching this year was great, actually. And I also have another opinion on the coaching thing with what's going on with Dwayne Casey. If you get swept
And this goes to Terry Stotts as well. If you get swept, it's not a coaching thing. It's a matchup. Like, if it's four...
Clearly.
Like, Terry Stotts is a great coach, and everybody was grumbling in Portland. Like, clearly Portland got the worst possible matchup they could get in the first round of the playoffs, as good as they were this year when they played you. Had they played us, they win the series. Or they could have won the series. We can't get shots. The Jazz can't get shots against them. Like, that's just... Whereas you can make every shot that they give you. When you get swept, it's a matchup issue, not a coaching issue.
I agree. But the only counter I would have to that, and it's pretty weak, is that, as you know, in a playoff series, it's all about adjustments and trying to counter the other's move. And what we saw in Portland's first-round series was the inability to counter or make a suitable adjustment. Even though the matchup didn't favor them, there really was not a good enough change or curveball thrown by Terry Stotts. And in Dwayne Casey's defense, look, LeBron James is mentally a problem for them. And again, I thought he played, you know, otherworldly against Toronto in that series. The coach of the year conversation is difficult because when do we cut off the voting? And if a team does get swept, in a tightly contested coach of the year race, you have to start splitting hairs somewhere. And maybe that's one of the hairs that has to get split.
Well, if we did coach of the year voting today, Brad Stevens would win. But had Brad Stevens played the Rockets or Brad Stevens played LeBron, I don't know that he wins the series. So it's just recency bias takes all of the things out of it. Let me share two things with you, then we'll get into Rockets, Warriors. Because they both just happened recently. I've been fortunate enough over the last 2 years that every morning on the road I go to coffee with Igor Kokoshkov, who's now the Suns' head coach. And he shared two things, one about playoff adjustments and one I think is important for the Raptors. One, the playoff adjustment comment he made to me was you can adjust offensively and it's very, very difficult to adjust defensively. That defensively is a five-man game of habits that you've built for 7 months. And when you start to change any of those things dramatically, inevitably one of your five guys will not execute it correctly. I thought that was really interesting. I'd never thought of that before.
Yes, and I think that, and we'll talk about this in the series in a moment, you know, that is left in the West, is that I think that also one thing that has to be included in that defensive conversation is if you remove one piece, albeit due to injury or a matchup, or whatever, that one piece, that one player who has settled into either a communicative role or a spacing role or a help side role, it changes the whole chemistry of a defense. And I think personnel is as equally as important in that conversation as, say, trying to do something you're not accustomed to doing as a group.
And then the other comment he made, this is Igor, by the way. I don't know if you've gotten to know him at all over the years, but... he's kind of just my joke with him all the time is he always tells me, you know, I had my grandfather, I can't do it in a Serbian accent. My Serbian coach when I was 13 used to say, and I always joke with him, like, to this day, I don't have any idea whether those are really people actually exist and they're your thoughts or whether you really, these people existed. And he always says to me, but if I said it was my thought, the first thing you would question is whether it's worth listening. If I tell you it's an old Serbian great leader, you'll start listening immediately. And I'm like, okay, fair point. But he said to me,
you know,
go ahead.
No, you know, I've known Igor since the 90s when he was on Quinn Snyder's first staff in Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember saying, it was either to Quinn or to John Hammond, who was also on that staff. I remember saying, who is this guy? And at the time, Igor's English was broken at best. And I said, who is this guy that's going to come in and be able to identify with these college athletes? And I know there's a European influence here, and I get that there could be a recruiting plus here. And I just found him to be so wise at such a young age and really just a guy who knew himself. And certainly that's grown. I'm so happy that he's now going to be a head coach. It's probably a little overdue, but timing is everything in the NBA.
And for those who don't know his backstory, the reason for his why he's so wise is he was one of the great Yugoslavian players when the country was won. With Vlade Divac and Petar Stojakovic, he gets in a car accident at 18 or 19 years old, ends up in the hospital for about 3 months, and it ruins his playing career. So he, at 18 or 19 years old, gets everything ripped away from him in life that he thought he was going to have, and then proceeds to go into coaching instead and become the first European coach ever. Trust me, my kids are going to hear that story once or twice. I'll be using it as a parenting model. Here was the other one he said to me about the playoffs, and I think this is a little bit of what kind of relates to who's still left in this thing, is he said to me, the playoffs are really a very, very turbulent airplane flight, and the question is whether you have a pilot who can land the plane. And Chris Paul very clearly landed the plane instead of James Harden in Houston. And DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry evidently are pretty good passengers, but may not be able to land a plane.
Totally fair. And one of the reasons why I think that Houston was so good during the regular season and why I think that they have a real legitimate shot as to going to the NBA Finals is that the Chris Paul factor adds another layer. Not only can he land the plane, but they now have two closers, which they've never had before. And Harden and Paul both, depending on if one yields to the other or if one is taken away by a good defense, and that is they have two different closers, and it's hard, you can't take both of them away. And so, therefore, that's why I think they've been able to finish games much better and why I think they have a real legitimate shot as to moving on.
He's Sean Kelly, radio voice of the New Orleans Pelicans. You've also heard him on plenty of national broadcasts before. We'll dig more into that specific Rockets-Warriors series as we continue. So when you played the Warriors for five games, prepped for them and all of that, what, Sean, jumped out to you about them that was better by seeing them up close, by prepping for them, than maybe you were previously aware of?
I think I knew all along that they were really good at switching one through four. I knew that their length was certainly a plus. But I guess I didn't realize how versatile they truly were in that they could use multiple lineups and make changes on the fly to take away something that you had somehow come up with in the flow of a particular game. That struck me a little bit more than I thought I was ready for.
It's interesting because what I was going to tell you that struck me on the Rockets is how great their switching defense is. I mean, it's really well, they do some special things with it, and they're really great at it. When Quinn got them in game two with an adjustment, they adjusted up to that as well as I've seen a team. So that's really interesting that both of us, what jumps out to us is really defensively how good they are switching.
Yeah, and I think that on the Houston side, PJ Tucker is a tremendous story for them. And I think he's the reason why they're able to do what you described.
I think it's Clint Capella. Clint Capella's defense at 20 feet is good. One of the adjustments that the Jazz made in Game 5 was to stop bringing Capella up on the pick and roll and just attack Harden. Because Capella was so much better and one of their best defenders in isolation. See, what I think gets
interesting. Great point.
Here's what gets interesting on this. The Warriors, for all their brilliance, their best isolation player is Steph Curry. Kevin Durant, and this is such a weird comment, I actually think is cursed by his ability to get shots off. In other words, he can get a shot off any moment, anytime, but sometimes I think he takes really difficult, hard shots, and it shows up a little bit in his efficiency ratings. He's good, but he's not great on some of the isolation stuff compared to James Harden, Chris Paul, Steph Curry, Eric Gordon. They're all better than he is in isolation. And if do you think Steph Curry's right?
Well, I think that part of Kevin Durant's problem is that he's really the only one they run pick and roll with. And teams are used to defending or scheming against pick and roll. So they're probably better at putting Kevin into awkward or more difficult situations as opposed to the read and react and off ball flares and the other nonsense that Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, and Andre Iguodala get their shots from. And that's the only thing I can maybe awkwardly throw out there with regard to your point about Kevin Durant. And that's why I think it'll be interesting to watch what the Rockets do as well, because they're going to have to adjust to playing a team that doesn't pick and roll as much as, say, Utah does or New Orleans does or most of the other teams currently in the West. And so, therefore, you know, that to me is one of the first things that I'll start to watch for.
It's a great point, because one of the things about the Rockets that's interesting is they force the most isolation of anyone in the league, like a huge amount. They 20% of all possessions they force into isolation. The next closest in the league is like 11%. But that's because most teams play pick and roll, and so you're playing pick and roll, they switch, now you're stuck in isolation. The Warriors run the fewest pick and rolls of anyone in the league. So from watching the Warriors, Sean, how do they take advantage of the Rockets switching?
Well, what they're going to try and do is keep you moving at all times, and they're going to shift the balance of the floor as much as they can. When you watch Steph Curry, he's trying to play to one side or the other, and therefore Klay Thompson's going to read and react off of him and try and find that awkward, unloaded side of the floor. By doing that, you take away kind of the high middle pick and roll. You allow Kevin Durant to either slip a screen or to post up perhaps a smaller player. One thing that works in the Rockets' favor is that I find that Trevor Ariza is a very decent wing defender. And unlike in the Pelican series or even against San Antonio, Kevin Durant now has a problem if Trevor Ariza finds himself patrolling Durant's movements. And so, therefore, that may counter a little bit of what Golden State likes to do.
It's really interesting. So one of the stats I love to look at is from Inpredictable, and it tells you what teams do after a made shot, after a defensive rebound, and after a turnover. And I was stunned and then very concerned when prepping for our series with the Rockets when I discovered that the Rockets were the third best team in the league defending after a made shot.
Well, there's no commitment to the offensive glass by the Rockets, number one, right? At least what I saw in the regular season.
Other than Capella, yeah.
And they're so used – yeah, other than Capella. And they're so used to shooting the long ball that the rebounds are so unpredictable that I think in some ways Mike D'Antoni has told them, just get back. Just get back, because the percentage of you rebounding one of those long kicks off the rim is probably lower than I've been able to track. You may have it, but – you know, it just seems it fits their style or is complementary to their style of offense and the way they want to attack the other end.
The weaknesses on each side, whose weakness is more severe, whose strength, what's the bending factor? We'll talk about it coming up with Sean Kelly of the New Orleans Pelicans Radio Voice as we continue to preview the Western Conference Series of the Rockets and the Warriors. All right, so who is a bigger liability defensively, Sean? Steph Curry or James Harden?
Wow, that's a great question. I think it might be Curry, just from a strength standpoint, in that his ability to fight over screens and try and slow down a larger guard seems to give him a few problems. Where Harden, it's kind of a 1-2 thing. When Harden wants to, I think he's a decent defender on the perimeter. It's the 1-2 thing that we'll have to watch for. And I think at this time of year and on this stage, the 1-2 or the commitment may be a little higher. So it's a compelling argument. I'll give the edge to Steph Curry in being perhaps the larger liability.
And the numbers back that up, by the way. The numbers back up that Steph isolation defense is far worse than James Harden. I mean, that's the only way I can really come up with a good new defensive numeric to try to answer that. It's interesting, though, because with the amount these teams switch, as the series moves on, as isolation becomes more prevalent, I think that's what this series becomes. I think this series becomes the Warriors hunting out Harden and the Rockets hunting out Steph Curry for matchups.
The problem in both of those scenarios is that Chris Paul will then have the ball in his hands probably more. and Chris's ability to change the tempo of an offensive possession or wait one more dribble or one more heartbeat for you to either overcommit or get caught when you're back to the ball is striking. And I think that Curry, his ability to create chaos on the offensive end above the foul line also makes that somewhat difficult. So they may cancel each other out in that situation.
The interesting mention there with Chris Paul that you had, Sean, is the Rockets about midway through the year slowed down. And you know, everybody talks about Mike D'Antoni 7 seconds or less. And frankly, by the end of the year, they were 7 seconds or less left on the shot clock. But when they did that, they stopped turning the ball over. And when they stopped turning the ball over, they stopped having to play transition defense. And when they're not a great elite athletic team, that's been a problem for them. They're much better. That's where they've really become a good defensive team. And that probably stems to Chris Paul, as you're talking about. At some point, they allowed Chris Paul to manage possessions, let James Harden do his slow walk-up. And I think that that suddenly gave them an advantage or a took away a disadvantage that people kind of thought of and that will be vital in this upcoming series. Because if they don't turn it over, the Warriors have a propensity to turn it over.
Yeah, I do think that. And I'll add one more thing to their want to slow it down a little bit or let Chris Paul watch things develop. And I think that's taking advantage of Clint Capella's ability to score at the rim, being a little more patient to get him loose, or either watching them systematically spread the floor with their shooters and create driving lanes as well. That takes a little bit of time, and we're talking about, you know, a matter of 10 seconds, but it's significant when you're looking at that stat.
Three-point shooting. If the Rockets go get 14 a game, they win. It's a lot, but they often get it. Do you think the Warriors, like the Jazz really tried to take away the Rockets' three-point shooting, just said you're not going to beat us from three, and then the Rockets torched them from the mid-range with Chris Paul, and by game five you could see that it had worn the Jazz out and the Rockets started to get threes again. What do you think the Warriors decide here?
I think they try and chase Houston off the line a little bit and take their chances with the mid-range jumper percentages-wise. You know, it's a gamble in a lot of ways because of Chris Paul. It's much like what Golden State does to teams when they're being chased off the line. They start to lean on a guy like David West, who's automatic from basically 9 to 13 feet. And so it may be the one old cliche of who's hitting shots and who's not in this series, because both teams are going to get tripped up either overcommitting to one or the other. If you sit back and let both of those teams fire away, you're going to pay. And at the same time, if you go out and try and chase teams off the line in this series, then inevitably somebody might get loose and kill you from mid-range or go backdoor on you, which the Warriors have the ability to do early in the series against the Pelicans when they were trying to take away the Warriors' three. A lot of weak side flash cuts, backdoor runs, those kind of things hurt the Pelicans. And just the opposite happened. Obviously, when the Pelicans shored up those things, their three ball became a little more prevalent.
You know, one thing I don't think anyone talks about in regards to the Warriors is how much they score at the rim. We think of them all as a jump shooting team, probably because Charles makes inaccurate comments on TNT. But they score as high a percentage just about anyone in the league at the rim. And you've got to try to take away the rim from them as much as you got to take away the Rockets' three.
Yeah, I agree. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that Draymond Green is such an operator in their offense, leads them in assists, and they almost invert their offense a lot of times to let Draymond Green catch lower on the floor and then operate the offense from there. And that allows for guys to dive to the rim. It also allows for Draymond to throw it out and then go slip a screen in trailing the pass, and then turn right around and go back to the rim because you're lifted now. I think that has something to do with it.
Anything that Alvin Gentry, with his, you know, has a really good coaching staff, did adjustment-wise to Golden State that Houston can learn from?
Well, I think that you have to be somewhat physical with Golden State in the few pick and rolls that they do run, And I think that you have to fight and lock and trail as best you can. Stay connected is probably the biggest message that Alvin Gentry would pass along to his good friend Mike D'Antoni. If you get disconnected from basically four of their five key guys, you're going to pay just because they move so well without the ball, and that's one of the keys in trying to beat them. It's easier said than done, but it has to be done in order to beat them.
It's really an interesting. It's going to be a fascinating series, and the different pieces. Who's your feeling that's the most important player?
Oh, boy, that's a really. Gosh, that's a deep question. It doesn't seem like it when you ask, but it really is. I really think that the most important player might be Chris Paul, just because of his ability to settle down Houston and to dictate the tempo on the floor. Because, look, Golden State wants to play with their hair on fire, and Houston doesn't mind playing that way, but as you pointed out, they have a propensity of turning the ball over a little bit when it does get cranked up. And so I think Chris's ability to dictate the tempo on the floor and keep them even-keeled, even though he's never been to a conference finals, I think he's still the most level-headed guy on the floor for Houston.
If I have to make a pick, go ahead, sorry.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, on the Golden State side, I still think it's Draymond Green and his ability to chase triple-doubles, which seems absurd, but they're undefeated when he gets it, and he's always flirting with it just because he does so many different things, and the emotion that he brings to the floor is not something that I think that Houston will handle very well.
So I was just going to say to you, sorry, it was watching the Rockets, I was only left with them having one weakness, which is they're just not great in transition defense, and that I think could be there. If I was making a pick in this series, I would take the Warriors solely based on the Rockets' Achilles heel of just not being great in transition. When they get their defensive set, they're long, they're great, they're versatile. Capella can guard outside, but when it gets off a miss or off a turnover, you can run on them. And Klay Thompson's going to get some looks, and Steph's going to get downhill, and they're going to get some plays in there. Is there any weakness you saw preparing for the Warriors that has you concerned?
A weakness on the Warriors' side. I think that they do struggle a little bit defending at the rim. And I do think that they can get into a situation where, this is something that I don't think I'll see in the conference finals, but they can take some possessions off. And I know Steve Kerr has been upset about that. We've seen him use almost more different starting lineups in the postseason than we saw in the regular season because he was frustrated with that. But I think we're now down to the conference finals. They've been here before, as we all know, and I don't see that maybe as a prevalent problem. They do love, as you mentioned, though, I just want to back up what you said, because they really make you pay. You could be in a 1-2 possession game with them, and one turnover, they're down the floor, it's a corner three. You go back up the floor, you get forced into an awkward shot, they rebound, and they're back down the floor, and they're at the rim with a layup. And all of a sudden, maybe you were down three, now you're down seven, and then it gets out of hand from there. They really know how to make you pay in those situations and throw a pretty big punch off of your miscues.
Well, it's certainly going to be an awesome series. Pelicans re-signed DeMarcus Cousins?
Good question. I thought I was going to have an answer for you at the end of the regular season. I don't. I thought I was going to have an answer for you after the Portland series. I didn't. And I'm not so sure I have a conclusive answer right now. I don't know if you learned enough to make a really great answer on this. I keep saying that they've got to find a way to find middle ground here. If you're going to sign him and he wants to stay with you, I think it has to be somewhere in between. It can't be the big max contract. And at the same time, I don't know if you know enough to just give up on the process that involves DeMarcus Cousins at the same time, just flat out ignoring the numbers that he was able to produce for you and the matchup problems. I just gave you a great non-answer.
No, it's a great, but it's so true. I mean, nothing's that easy. What's the trickle-down effect? What happens to Nikola Mirotic? Does he stay if DeMarcus stays, or does he have to go if DeMarcus stays?
Well, let's just say Cousins is back. I think Mirotic stays. He's under contract. I'm not so sure that even if Cousins didn't get hurt, they still wouldn't have tried to go get him because they still needed some depth behind those two bigs. And they just frankly didn't have it. They kind of made do and they needed that additional piece. So Mirotić has to be a part of that conversation. I think the bigger conversation, if Cousins stays, is can you find a way to keep Rondo? And it may be him having to take a lower number that he would get on the open market, but Rondo was as much of a part of the success with Cousins as anything else, and so that becomes maybe the bigger question.
Interesting. Great point. Sean, always a pleasure. Have a great offseason. Hopefully I'll talk to you throughout it, and I will see you soon.
You know we will. Enjoy the series. I think we're watching the NBA championship on the western side of the bracket here coming up.
Oh, I'm not. I have no doubts. I have no doubt at all. Thanks, my man. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care, David.